The bank board would go to the investor with a list of the assets. The investor would choose the assets that he would take responsibility for. Obviously, the performing loans, the ones that were worth a lot of money, and so forth. All of the bad assets, the defaulted loans, the REO that was no good, and so forth, he still owned because the bank board couldn't take it. They didn't have any organization or any money to do it. But bank board said, we will guarantee those. So if you've got a non-performing loan, don't worry about it. We'll pay it. And we'll give you a promissory note right here from the federal government. Okay? For 10 years, we'll pay off all of those bad assets.
It's a good insurance policy.
Wow.
You know what the investors, or the potential investors said? No deal. We want to make some profit on our money. Danny Wall said, no sweat. We'll give you 2% profit on everything, all the bad assets. We'll not only pay them off, we'll give you 2%. The guy said, well, I don't know. You know, I've got to chase these people. I've got to hire lawyers. I've got to litigate this stuff. No problem. We'll pay the lawyers' fees, whether they're successful or not.
We being the federal government.
The federal government. There were very optimistic expectations about some of these people picking up payments, even though they hadn't paid for 2 years and this kind of stuff. And so the estimate by the bank board at the time was $24.5 million to close these thrifts, or to sell them. Right now, it's close to $50 billion, and most experts give a range of $75 to $100 billion. For just this, there were 15 transactions.
And this is just in the Southwest Plan.
Right, it's called the Southwest Plan. Now,
and that's what they were saying the entire bailout bill was going to be a few months ago.
Exactly. Now catch this. One guy who's been
more.
The effect is this. The middle class is going to disappear. More and more and more people are living in poverty. In fact, there was a report recently in the paper that 32% of the people in this country are effectively living in poverty because they're shelter poor. When after they pay their mortgage, they don't have enough left for the basic necessities of life as defined by the federal Department of Health and Human Services. Mm. So that's 78 million people in this country are already at the poverty level.
And
we're just starting.
The second in our two-part series, presenting an update on the savings and loan situation, with more about the schemers, the scammers, and how it fits into the total economic situation in the U.S. right now on Alternative Views. First program in our two-part series, providing you an update on the SNL situation, we talked about a lot of the scams that went on, and Rob Whittleson also was telling us about how the regulations changed here and there, which caused great consternation among the SNL owners. But before we talk about the SNL situation, here are some stories about Iraq.
The media, of course, have vilified Saddam Hussein as a madman, a Hitler, and worse, and have whipped up anti-Arab war fever. They've presented the military intervention by the U.S. as natural and as inevitable, and have mainly focused on the logistics of the operation. The U.S. military couldn't have asked for better advertisements or PR. Almost every day, the news is completely dominated by pictures of the U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, troops preparing to go, the logistics and technical details of the U.S. intervention. And this is the biggest advertisement for the military that we've seen since Vietnam. This U.S. intervention has also taken place in the context of a debate over the cutting back of the budget of the military and the CIA, and defenders of these institutions have used the crisis in the Gulf to support their arguments against military cutbacks. For instance, the stealth bomber was killed by Congress just before the invasion, and now it's back on the books, and we're building the stealth bomber again. In the early days of the invasion, the only critique of the timing of Bush's intervention, of his sending troops to the Mideast, was from the families of hostages who'd wished he'd given them time to get out before sending in U.S. troops. And the only critical voices criticizing the U.S. military presence were Arab intellectuals in Egypt, Jordan, and the other countries in which the television networks had stationed their crews.
One of the things that is not mentioned very much, at least I haven't heard it recently, they kind of refer to it a little bit, and that is the response of the Arabs in general throughout the so-called Arab world. They hate that term, the Arabs I talk to. They hate that term, Arab world, but nonetheless, I guess we got to use it. But they say that they, most of the people on the streets, see this as an unfolding of the old plot of the Arabs trying to regain control of their own countries, their own territory, their own economy, which has been dominated by the colonialist powers for all these years, particularly the oil companies that are supported by the colonialist powers. They also see it as a matter of the rich against the poor, Republican against monarchist, pro-Western against nationalist, and the pan-Arab nationalism has really popped up again and has swept the area like it hasn't done since about 1967. There even caused some divisions within the Arab League itself, although it voted 12-3 to support the United States. There was a lot of acrimonious debate before this occurred. There have been mass demonstrations in support of Iraq from Algeria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Somalia. So while the regular media focus just on the heads of state, a lot of different things are happening down below with the people in general.
I've not seen any coverage of any demonstrations in the United States against the U.S. sending troops to Saudi Arabia. Supposedly there have been some that I've heard and read about, but I haven't seen any television pictures of any.
Well, there's one factor in this that the Arabs are very, the Arab people on the street are very well aware of, and that is the history of the area, which I've only seen referred to once on the media, and that, of course, I don't see all of it. But that is the fact that Kuwait was a part for centuries of Iraq. It was part of the province of Basra, but the British detached that area, they grabbed that area from Iraq while it was part of the Ottoman Empire, and set up this separate little state called Kuwait, which has, by the way, the second largest oil reserves in the world, next to Saudi Arabia. And the British kept control of this area over Iraq's objections until 1961, when they gave Kuwait its independence. At that time, Iraq really was fuming because they wanted the territory back, but they didn't do it. So the Iraqi government was fomenting a lot of interest and focusing a lot of attention on Iraq. They wanted to go back and take, on Kuwait rather, they wanted to take the area back. Well, it just so happened that there was a little coup in 1963, which the CIA was involved in. And so after that, around that time, and the new government came in, and they immediately dropped their demands of getting back Kuwait. And in 1963, they recognized the independence of Kuwait. So whether the Arabs say that was their real Arab expression or whether it was just part of the age-old CIA activity where a client was put in to do the U.S. bidding is something else. But the Arabs remember this is really part of ancient Iraqi territory.
Frank, there's a lot of information about Kuwait in an article by Alexander Coburn in the August the 27th Nation that sums up or fleshes out some of the points that you made. Coburn points out that Kuwait has some 2 million citizens, of which only, or 2 million inhabitants, of which only 535,000 are citizens. So it's mostly immigrant workers that make up the population of Kuwait. Of these citizens, only 60,000 voted in Kuwait's limited parliamentary election, the last of which was held in 1985. For the past 4 years, the emir of Kuwait has ruled by decree, having suspended parliament. The truth is that only the Al-Sabah family and the Bedouin tribes really like the government, said a Kuwaiti who was quoted in the London Times of August the 6th, particularly in the past 2 years when members of the former parliament and other respected critics of the regime of the emir were arrested and beaten up because they wanted a new parliament. Even the middle-class Kuwaitis have been alienated from their government, and it's all the fault, according to this Kuwaiti, of the emir himself, that he despised everyone who wasn't a Sabah or a Bedouin, a member of those two tribes. Coburn also quotes his friend Fred Halliday, who wrote in a 1974 book, Arab Without Sultans, that behind the propaganda about miracles and a Gulf El Dorado, i.e. Kuwait, it was really a viciously reactionary state. In 1971, for instance, it was calculated that 90% of all Kuwaiti investments abroad were controlled by a mere 18 families. By 1970, about 80% of the labor force was made up of immigrants from Iraq, Iran, Oman, the Yemens, Pakistan, and India. Moreover, these immigrant workers weren't allowed to go to school, didn't receive health care, were in a second-class citizenship. Actually, 10% of the number of immigrants were allowed to attend schools, which was a small percentage of them, and none of them received good housing or health care, and were all being sort of gorged by landlords and exploited by doctors and the medical system. So it's clearly one of the most reactionary countries in the world, along with Saudi Arabia.
It's not as bad as Saudi Arabia, but just about.
So the U.S. goes into Panama to overthrow Noriega, to restore democracy. And here's one of the most democratic governments in the world, and they want to move in to restore the monarch. This strikes me as a contradiction, or two contradictions, in U.S. policy.
Well, another contradiction is the fact, as Coburn points out in an article in these Times, that the U.S. has been supporting Hussein for years and didn't let out a peep when Hussein was sending poisoning gas over and killing a lot of the people in his own country, the Kurds. And they also supported Hussein and his war against Iran. As a matter of fact, as Coburn points out, 10 days before the invasion, the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs was asked if they thought Saddam was acting like a Hitler. And this guy said, Richard Murphy, he said, well, that comparison is too glib. And he said that Saddam, well, he's a rough, direct-talking leader. And now all of a sudden he's a real bad guy because...
Well, the same with Noriega. Noriega was a good friend of the U.S. until he refused to support the Contras and to invade Nicaragua, and then suddenly he becomes a bad guy.
Well, Coburn also points out some of the hypocrisies and double standards. It says Israel has been sitting on Arab land since 1967, and Turkey has been holding northern Cyprus illegally since 1974, and when Saddam Hussein launched his invasion of Iran back in 1980, the UN Security Council failed to consider the matter for 2 weeks. But boy, they jumped in right fast when the U.S. wanted something on this invasion of Kuwait. The condemnation from the Security Council did not come. They didn't condemn it. They just called for a ceasefire in place. And this was after the Iraqis were already 30 miles inside Iranian territory. Well, that's all the time we have for news. Now let's turn our attention to the SNL situation. We start this program by talking about the Southwest Plan, which was hatched up by Danny Wall, who had been the replacement for Edwin Gray as head of the bank board.
The infamous Southwest Plan, which was an enormous giveaway.
How'd that work?
Well, after 86, 87, when the industry was falling apart. The bank board was going in and taking over all of these insolvent thrifts. I mean, they were losing money daily. $10 million a day was pouring out. So it behooved the industry to take over these thrifts. But when they did, they had to pay off the deposits. They had to pay off the interest and so forth. Now, according to the charter of the FSLIC, the insurance corporation, all thrifts paid insurance premiums into a pool. And that pool was rapidly depleted. In 1987, a boost to that pool was passed through Congress of $11 billion.
Where the federal government just put the money into the
They loaned it to the to the FSLIC.
Okay.
And by the way, Jim Wright resigned over machinations of this $11 million. But anyway, that's another story.
And Coelho also resigned because he was compromised by the SNL in California.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, with Columbia Savings. And he was also a good friend of Mike Milken's. But again, that's another story. So with the bank board taking over all these thrifts, all the money disappeared real fast. Now it's 1988. There are 197 losing savings and loans in the Southwest, mainly in Texas. They're hemorrhaging money out. It's and the insurance fund is broke. So Danny Wall, who's now the head of the bank board, decides that what he's going to do is work out a deal with wealthy capitalists around the country to buy up these banks so that the bank board won't have to take them over. So he's got to convince these guys to buy these losing propositions. Okay, so here's what he did. First of all, he packaged them up, 10 here, 20 here. And he went to these wealthy folks, Robert Bass, one of the Hunts, a guy named Perlman, Ronald Perlman, who's head of Revlon Corporation, and James Fail, who we'll talk about in a minute. And all of the deals, although many of them are still secret, they all, as far as we can tell, shared some common characteristics. And here's the way they went down. The bank board would go to the investor with a list of the assets. The investor would choose the assets that he would take responsibility for. Obviously, the performing loans, the ones that were worth a lot of money, and so forth. All of the bad assets, the defaulted loans, the REO that was no good, and so forth, he still owned because the bank board couldn't take it. They didn't have any organization or any money to do it. But bank board said, we will guarantee those. So if you've got a non-performing loan, don't worry about it. We'll pay it. And we'll give you a promissory note right here from the federal government. Okay? For 10 years, we'll pay off all of those bad assets.
It's a good insurance policy.
Wow.
You know what the investors or the potential investors said? No deal. We want to make some profit on our money. Danny Wall said, no sweat. We'll give you 2% profit on everything. All the bad assets. We'll not only pay them off, we'll give you 2%. The guy said, well, I don't know. You know, I've got to chase these people. I've got to hire lawyers. I've got to litigate this stuff. No problem. We'll pay the lawyer's fees, whether they're successful or not.
We being the federal government.
The federal government, that's right.
And how much money did he have to do these things?
Well,
and where did he get it?
Well, he didn't get it.
All he had to do was write checks.
IOUs.
Yeah.
IOUs. Well, the original value of the notes, and of course, there were very optimistic expectations about some of these people picking up payments even though they hadn't paid for 2 years and this kind of stuff. And so the estimate by the bank board at the time was $24.5 million to close these thrifts or to sell them. Right now, it's close to $50 billion, and most experts give a range of $75 to $100 billion for just this. There were 15 transactions.
And this is just in the Southwest, the Southwest Plan.
Right, it's called the Southwest Plan. Now,
that's what they were saying the entire bailout bill was going to be a few months ago.
Exactly. Now, catch this. One guy who's been in the news quite a bit lately is a guy named James Fail. Now he's an insurance guy. He's had insurance companies, And in 1976, one of his companies was convicted of a felony, fraud, and he was indicted, but he copped a plea and got out of it. But he was barred from selling insurance in the state of Alabama. He's also been barred from several other states for various malpractices. So he comes along and he buys, as part of the Southwest plan, 15 failed savings and loans. He packages them together, calls it Blue Bonnet Savings, and he goes into business.
Well, how did they let him do that if he was such a bad guy?
Well, that's funny you would mention that. He hired a lobbyist, a guy named Robert Thompson. Now, Thompson is an interesting guy because he's a close friend of Prescott Bush Jr., George Bush's brother. And in fact, in 1979, this lobbyist Thompson was actually on George Bush's campaign staff when he was going for presidency. And in 1980, when Bush became vice president, Thompson became a legislative aide, a liaison between Congress and the White House. So he got to know everybody. And in 1983, he quits his job and he goes into the lobbying business. And he, the first thing he does, he sends out promotional flyers on Thompson and Company stationery that says he has breakfast once a month with George Bush. So he had a successful lobbying business. So in 1988, James Fail comes along and says, I want a piece of the Southwest plan action. Can you help me? And the guy says, no problem, Thompson. And Thompson takes all of the documents through the approval process where they're supposed to look and see if these guys have been felons and whatever. And some of the forms disappear, and the boxes don't get checked right, and son of a gun, Fail ends up with Blue Bonnet Savings. Now, Blue Bonnet Savings has $3 billion in total assets. Okay, 1.85 is guaranteed, those promissory notes, from the government. Okay, now, Fail paid $70 million to get into that deal. So he got $3 billion for an initial, he had to put in his own capital, $70 million. Well, that $70 million he borrowed, some of it from his own insurance company. What he actually put up out of his own pocket was $1,000.
He got $30 billion in assets?
$3 billion
for $1,000?
I would have given him $2,500. You know, why didn't they talk to me? So, interestingly enough, in 1989, just to finish the story, Blue Bonnet Savings was the single most successful, most profitable thrift. Now, thrifts are there to make loans. Guess how many loans Blue Bonnet Savings made in 1989?
Thousands.
Four
big ones.
Four loans. One of three of which I don't know about. One was to a lobbyist named Robert Thompson, $350,000.
Oh.
No kidding. So, Fail got his banks, even though he wasn't eligible because of his previous history.
Thompson got his payoff.
Thompson got his payoff. Plus, he got 2% of the profits from Blue Bonnet in the first several years.
The lobbyist.
Did, yeah, 2%.
Now, is Thompson in jail yet?
No. Hey, what are you kidding? He's a good friend of Prescott Bush.
Well,
he has breakfast with George Bush every month.
How did he get the 2% of the profits? That was just part of the deal?
That was part of the deal, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, took 2%. So, that's the Southwest plan. And that's considered to be one of the most egregious offenses in this whole nasty story. And this was this particular part came from the regulators. So this was a Danny Wall arranged.
The message of all this seems to be that every time Congress tries to do something to deal with this SNL crisis, they do something that makes things worse. And when the federal regulatory apparatus sticks their hand in the pie and they try to clean up the mess, they make it even worse. Has this been the accelerating story of the worsening of the crisis of the SNL? This is the way your story sounds to me.
Exactly. Now, if you think about it, there were three real strong players here. There's Congress, right, and the legislative apparatus, including the White House. And then you've got the regulatory apparatus here. And then you've got the savings and loans.
The players.
And if you listen to the players and the SNLs, they're blaming the regulators. The regulators are blaming Congress. Congress is blaming the SNL guys.
Sounds like there's plenty of blame to go around to everybody.
Some of the regulators were in bed, of course, as we talked about, interlocked and in bed with the industry. But the good guys, the regulators who were taking their job seriously and were trying to keep things under control, like Edwin Gray, who was head of the bank board, Congress kicked him out. And the bank examiners in California who were trying to make Keating toe the line with Lincoln Savings, they were stomped on by the boys higher up.
Five, right?
Yeah.
The Atlanta people were trying to investigate Florida and some of the problems down there, and they were given a hard time by both Congress and the people they were trying to investigate.
Exactly. And it goes even further than that. Edwin Gray, in 1984, when he realized, he started to see what was going on, he said, first of all, they had slashed the budget of the regulators, slashed it by more than half over the previous few years. So he had minimal staff. It was 2-3 years before they got back into a bank after an examination. Between examinations, 2-3 years sometimes. And the salaries were incredibly low. All of the good people had been sucked out and gone into other organizations, like the FDIC, for example. And what they had was a bunch of people that just got out of college, who were looking for a job, you know, and they got something, $26,000 a year, something like that. And they were the ones responsible for trying to figure all this stuff out. In fact, I was talking to one of the executives at Lamar during this period. And he told me about a regulator. Now, this is a guy, you know, he's been in the business 20 years. And a regulator, 26 years old, comes in. He's got 6 months' experience. He's sitting there, and he's going through these folders, and his eyes are crossing. And the executive is pointing things out and saying, hey, now, don't forget to look at this here and see this here. And here's the list for due diligence over here. You know? So, Gray went to... His apparatus was controlled by OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. So Gray called David Stockman, who was in charge at the time, and he said, David, help. I need more people. I need better salaries. I got to have some money. And Stockman said, wait a minute. You mean you want more regulation? This is the era of deregulation. You want more regulation? That's tantamount to treason. And he wasn't kidding. They were talking.
He was an ideologue. He was a hardcore deregulation will solve all problems.
Exactly. And Ed Gray, for all his goodness of spirit, was derisively known in Washington as the great re-regulator. That was the label that they stuck on him.
Because deregulation run amok.
The situation got nothing but worse. Bush comes into office and he presents a bailout package.
This is 89 now.
This is early 89. And
now his first actions as president.
Exactly, 28 days or something into his presidency. And a lot of the package was based in what he had learned in 1984 when he was head of the White House task force to oversee deregulation. And they had proposals then that they chose not to present. But some of them were incorporated into the bailout bill of last summer, which was called FIREA, the Federal Institution Recovery, Reform, and Enforcement Act.
You got to have an acronym, or
exactly.
You're not doing something important.
The bureaucraties.
Bush bailout is what I call it. Anyway, there was an interesting provision in the Bush bailout that I want to bring up here. Now, remember, we had the Tax Reform Act of 1981 and then the Tax Reform Act of 1986 that reversed all of those changes and effectively cut the industry down. Now, in the bailout bill, there's a little clause that says goodwill is no longer valid. Okay. Now, goodwill was something that the bank board had offered during the time when the SNLs were starting to crash. Again, they were looking for ways to shore up insolvent SNLs without putting any money in, because during lots of that period, there was no money in the insurance fund. So the regulators worked out deals. If there was an insolvent thrift, let's say there's a thrift that had was $50 million in the red, they would go to a nearby thrift and they would say, we want you to buy that bad thrift. And they'd say, well, that's crazy. Why should I do that? I'm going to lose $50 million and then I'm insolvent. So the bank board said, no sweat. If you buy that thrift, we will give you something called goodwill, $50 million worth. You can put it on your books, and so your books will be balanced. And you'll help us out, and you'll get that other thrift. And when the bank examiners come along, they have to add in this $50 million on the profit side, so that your books aren't crashed by this insolvent savings and loan. So there were all these institutions around the country who had bought up other insolvent thrifts to help out the bank board, and they had taken on goodwill in good faith. Now the bailout bill comes along in 1989. Now remember, the bailout bill was bailing out approximately 275 to maybe 300 badly insolvent thrifts, $50 billion, right? Then, in the bailout bill, it says goodwill is no longer valid. So this thrift that had a $50 million plus, suddenly it's gone, evaporated.
And it's insolvent.
Now they're insolvent. And so if you remember, 6 months after the bailout bill, suddenly they announced that, oops, another 500 thrifts couldn't meet the capital requirements. They were going to go down.
That's
why. It was the damn goodwill.
So it made it worse. So every time that there's a government action on this, it intensifies in a qualitative way,
exponential way.
Exponential.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. I mean, something like this is just, I mean, that's why at the beginning of the program I said something about conspiracies. I mean, it's so obvious that you'd think that it's intentional.
I saw an article that in the Dallas newspaper, that the regulators are wanting to renege on the Southwest plan and make that retroactive. Now, is this part of what you're talking about?
Well,
or is that something separate?
It's a new development.
Well, it's a slightly new development. Part of this has to do with James Fail, the blue bonnet savings guy, because they're saying that he obtained his Southwest plan deal fraudulently, because the papers that were submitted weren't clear about his past history, which would have barred him from participating. So that's one aspect of why they're going to renege on his deal. But in addition, what they're saying is, you remember the deal was that all the bad assets that the investor or the buyer chose not to take control of, the government said they would guarantee. And that agreement, those were called yield maintenance agreements. They would maintain the yield on this loan even if it was defaulted on. Okay? So in other words, you've got you loan out some money, the guy defaults, he's not giving you any payments anymore. And the investor, Fail, has to take that loan as part of the Southwest plan. And the government said, we'll make the payments. See, that's what the guarantee is. We'll make the payments, we'll give you 2% profit, and we'll pay your legal fees.
Okay.
And we'll give you 2% profit on the legal fees.
Yeah.
Okay, don't forget that. So, what the government is saying now is that those agreements means that effectually the government bought that loan, and it belongs to the government. Okay, so now they're going to say, all of those guaranteed loans and all those guaranteed assets are ours.
Wasn't that just as well with guys like Fail, because they don't have those bad loans, those non, or is it bad because they're not getting the government nipple to suck on?
Remember that Fail's Blue Bonnet Savings was the most successful savings and loan, and the reason was that he got his first guaranteed payment from the government of $275 million.
So that's why he didn't make any loans. He didn't have to. The government gave him $275 million to make up for those bad loans. Okay, so that's where the money's going. The government's saying, wait a minute, we got the resolution trust now, we have a place to put things, and we're just going to take all that stuff back. And we're not going to pay you those guarantees anymore.
Rob, what is the effect of this, of the government reneging on the Southwest plan, going to be for other people like Fayol?
That depends on the specifics of each of the deals. In other words, there were 15 transactions. Okay, so 15 wealthy investors took over a total of 197 SNLs. Some of them got incredible sweetheart deals. Here's an example. Ronald Perelman, he got to write off all of those bad assets that the government guaranteed. Even though the government was paying him for it and he was making a profit on them, he got to write them off as a tax break. He got a $1.5 billion tax break, okay, on those savings and loans. Now, in addition, he got the government to agree. See, he wasn't making that much profit on those savings and loans. So he had more tax break on his savings and loan company, First Gibraltar, than he did on any of his other holding companies. So he got the government to agree that he could float that tax break throughout his other holding companies. So if he made $500 million on this company back here, he'd just suck off $500 million tax break from the savings and loan side and dump it over here, and he wouldn't have to pay any tax on that company either. Okay? So now he's got a sweetheart deal.
At the expense of the government and the taxpayers.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the taxpayers are the ones who are getting
money
killed.
Taken from the tax fund.
Exactly.
And that's where my checking account is. I'm going to withdraw my $230. Ruin old Perelman.
Now, some of the other Southwest plan deals have not been quite as successful. There's one bought by a company called Lone Star Technologies. I'm not sure who's involved personally, you know, the names, but Lone Star. And they haven't been doing quite as well. They didn't get the great tax break. They were a little more responsible. They chose to take responsibility themselves for more of the assets, and they haven't done quite as well. So they actually lost money. Hmm. So the reports I read say that it depends on how well you negotiated your Southwest plan. It looks like Fayol's is going to be terminated. The others, it will, again, they'll have to renegotiate.
Such a strange, this whole thing is strange.
It's gambling. It's like sort of a gambling thing where the rules keep changing.
Yeah, and there's, and because the rules keep changing, and because there's so much turmoil and so much money, those who are in the know make big bucks, and if you're a little slow, if you're not right in the heart of it.
Or you don't have the right connections. I mean, that's
exactly
another thing.
You get killed. I'll give you an example. Okay. First Gibraltar was a big savings and loan in Houston. It was going down. There were several stockholders, major stockholders. Two of them were named Robert Strauss and Ricky Strauss.
Oh.
Bob Strauss.
The big guys in the Democratic Party.
Right. Okay, now they were big stockholders in First Gibraltar. They were also the only two stockholders to sell off their stock and get their money out before First Gibraltar went down. Now, Robert Strauss is a partner in a law firm in Dallas called Akin and Gump. Akin and Gump was Ronald Perelman's law firm when he took over First Gibraltar. So, what I reconstruct is that First Gibraltar's in trouble. It's going to be part of the Southwest plan. Danny Wall goes to Ronald Perelman and says, hey, you got money. You want to take over these thrifts, and they negotiate. Well, Akin and Gump is the law firm that helps those negotiations. Robert Strauss is a partner in Akin and Gump, and he's a big stockholder in First Gibraltar, so he yanks his money out. Then they do the deal. Everybody loses money except Strauss.
Any way to estimate the extent of the financial disaster here, or is it just changing so rapidly that it's really
fictive.
It's changing rapidly, and one of the reasons is that remember that a lot of this money was lost because of that hyperinflated equity. It was an inflated equity. Now the bottom is dropping out of all of those projects, all of those developments, all of the loans, and so the appraised value, the market value of the assets that were loaned against keeps dropping, and so you lose more and more money. So we won't know until the real estate market drops or stops dropping, until it bottoms out.
So all the extra amount that was as a result of all this land flipping, which was fictitious, yes, and just fake value, is going down to where it should
be started out with.
Uh-huh. But remember, we've got another problem now. All of these assets, enormous number of assets, are in the Resolution Trust Corporation. That's the bailout, right? So now the Wall Street Journal says that the Resolution Trust will do for real estate what the silos did for the value of the price of corn in the Midwest. You remember we started stockpiling grain, mm-hmm, and subsidizing farmers?
So prices went way down.
That's right. And it's controlled now. Effectively, the real estate market is controlled by the Resolution Trust Corporation.
So there's not going to be much new construction because there's so much over construction now, and prices are going down. But there's a catch here. This sounds like it's good for the consumer, for the house buyer. If the prices are going down, that means more people will be able to buy houses or office buildings. But the catch is they're having more trouble borrowing money for these houses or for buying development projects because of the tight restrictions now.
Well, that's
on loans.
That's exactly
is that,
right.
Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Hearing.
There's something called a credit crunch. And part of this, there are several parts to what you're talking about. First of all, remember that the banking industry, particularly the what's called the thrift industries, although
it's
some
gone.
Question whether it's going to survive, has been concentrated. Once again, we have a concentration into fewer and fewer hands. So the thrift industry is no longer mom and pop, independent entities in each little town. Okay, for example, here in Texas, NCNB is the big bank now. Enormous bank.
It's from North Carolina.
It's from North Carolina. Okay? So they come into Texas. Now, you've got somebody that bought a house for $100,000, they took out an $80,000 note. Real estate prices are dropping. Now their house is worth $60,000, but they've got an $80,000 note. So NCNB says, hey, wait a minute. I want to stop that deal. So they foreclose. They just say, hey, we're going to stop it now before the price drops anymore. We lose more money. So they're throwing people out of their homes. For example, many people in the boom time took out what they call mini-perm mortgages. They were mini-permanent. They were short-term mortgages to be rolled over and renegotiated after 3 years or 5 years.
Oh, I remember that. I thought, my God, who but a fool would do that?
Well,
because you're never telling what's going to come up after three or 5 years.
That's right.
You've got to come up. Because you've got to come up with the amount of money for the whole thing at the end of this term, 5 years or whatever.
That's right, and that's what's happening.
If you bought a $100,000 house and you make payments for 5 years, then at the end of that 5 years, you've got to come up and pay off the rest of it.
Uh-huh. So they're foreclosing on those. Now, one of the reasons is, remember in the Southwest plan, they could mark off the good assets that they wanted to keep, and they dumped the rest on the government. And they were allowed to do that for a period of 2 years after they did the deal. So what that means is, if after a year and a half they've got an asset that stopped performing, or as we were saying, the value drops and it's not well collateralized, or the people got behind 1 month a couple times, then they just say, well, we're not going to deal with this. And they write it off. And there's, you know, the person who's lost their mortgage, lost their home. Lines of credit that were extended have been shut. And it gets even more ominous. I've got a friend who's got small businesses, three of them. Two of them are travel agencies, and over the past several years, he's done a lot of work for the government. So IRS people need to travel around, they use his agency. And so he's built up a big stack of accounts receivable from the federal government. He can't get paid. He's got to keep his business going, so he goes to his local bank. He's worked with him for some time. And he says, can you lend me some money, and I'll give you these accounts receivable from the government as collateral. You know what the bank said? Forget it. Not worth the paper they're printed on. So, if there's any question at all, they're shutting down. And the reason is it's not worth it to them. They have no interest in the community. They're huge.
They don't care about
faceless
people,
bureaucracies. Right. I mean, they're just interested in
bottom line.
Exactly.
Profit.
Now, on the other hand, you've got the Resolution Trust Corporation, and that's stockpiling all of these enormous assets. That hangs like a weight over the real estate market in this country.
Because they have all these properties that can be unloaded that preclude building new ones.
Exactly. And now what they've just decided to do, a new policy, is they're packaging huge chunks of real estate and they're selling them to single investors or to single companies. So what we have is in the banking system a concentration, and in the real estate a concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, as we've seen throughout the 80s, now into the 90s, this enormous concentration of wealth in a few hands.
But it's also a concentration of debt. In other words, you have the federal deficit building up. You have deficits from this SNL making claims on federal monies.
Well, that's something else that's important, I think, to look at. Really, what the SNL situation has done is borrow money from the future, okay? Because we're selling the bonds now, but it's our children that will have to pay them off, pay the principal off, right. And we'll pay interest for 30 years.
So it's mortgage, really.
Right, it's a mortgage for
the entire
future.
Economy.
That's right. Now, the interesting question is, who buys the Treasury bonds? And it appears that it's one-third foreign investors, and the other two-thirds are split roughly in half, financial institutions and corporate capitalists.
Which is, again, concentrating property in small amounts of people's hands.
Exactly. I mean, we're basically subsidizing. I mean, it's like it's the
foreign
term
capital
I use,
and big capital.
It's like serfdom. I mean, we're tithing a percentage of our taxes, which is going to rise. It's already a third of the budget, right?
And
it's
the deficit.
The deficit.
Right.
So we're going to have to make these interest payments, and then our kids are going to have to pay it off, and they're going to pay it to those guys, the wealthy,
who benefited from this whole thing to start out with.
Exactly.
Could this be a conspiracy of the rich to concentrate capital in their hands?
Well, see, I knew
we
something
have
was
had
going to say conspiracy.
We've had some Republicans that captured the state in the 1980s and the 1980s that represent the interests of big corporations and big business. You don't think they were putting through policies that might have just benefited them and their friends at the expense of everyone else?
Oh, no, they wouldn't do that.
Something like that could happen in a great democracy?
Well, as I said earlier, I'm not going to outline any specific conspiracy theory, but boy, it sure makes you
wonder. That's the effect. Actually, if you have a war with Iraq to deflect attention from this kind of thing,
yeah.
I mean, this brings the whole question of the media in. To what extent has the media explained any of this complex story that you're telling? I've been getting bits and pieces sometimes from the New York Times and mainly the alternative press, but this is one of the most underreported stories of the century.
I know. It's funny because the savings and loan crisis is a vastly reported story, but it's a surface look.
And it's
what
details of individual corruption without seeing the structural factors behind this, the policy decisions, the games people were playing, the effects of these games.
Exactly. And a lot of people are going to be hurt by this. I mean, this is just a disaster. And, you know, we're in pretty good shape here in Texas. I mean, we have all these empty office buildings that eventually will fill up. And, you know, all that money that was being siphoned off, a lot of it was siphoned off into Texas. But what's going to happen in the Northeast or in some other place where the money wasn't sent and now, of course, there's a focus on the regional effects of the bailout. Those people are going to be taxed just like us, and they're going to send the money down here.
To pay off for the wheelers and dealers in this region accrued these big gambling debts.
That's exactly right. And so there's a Phil Graham up in the Senate was booed and hissed the week before they stopped. They quit for the summer. Because he suggested that they redistribute some community development grants. And I mean, they were mad at him. They were mad. They said some vile things to that guy.
What effect has all this had on various public institutions or strata, such as schools, that rely on taxes, property taxes, where there's all this all these empty buildings and no taxes coming from them? What's happening?
Well, that's an interesting question. Our local tax assessor, named Cecilia Burke, says that the Resolution Trust, who of course has to pay the taxes on all those properties, it's part of the carrying costs.
Really?
Yes, of course. They own it.
That's part of the bailout expense. The government owns all these non-functioning things. They've got to pay taxes on.
The Resolution Trust has the rough costs of the assets in the Resolution Trust are 25% annually, carrying charges, just carrying charges to manage, to keep track of, and pay the taxes.
And that's how much a year?
Well, if they've got what do they got now, 300 billion or 200 billion in assets, that's 50 billion a year just in carrying charges that disappears. So you're asking about the total cost. There are some folks who are now talking about $2 trillion, and I'm up in that category. That's what I think it's going to be, if you include all these other charges. Now, the problem is that the Resolution Trust, according to Cecilia Burke, our local tax assessor, is a deadbeat.
They're not paying.
Now, what that means is that services, schools, everything that depends on properties, all of
water development,
structural stuff,
in the communities. The federal government is paying the taxes through the Resolution Trust to the local community, and if they don't pay, then the funds aren't there.
Exactly.
Because they would have expected these business and development corporations to pay off.
That's right. Plus, you combine that with a credit crunch, a contraction of credit, and shuts down small businesses. People's homes get foreclosed on. The unemployment. So the tax base goes out there, too. I mean, you don't have all this money flowing around, so you can't tax it.
This sounds to me like a downward spiral.
Oh.
I mean, this sounds to me like something worse than the Great Depression is coming. It was just based on stock market machinations and some overinflated, you know, businesses.
Well, the effect...
This sounds structurally much more...
The effect is this. Yeah. The middle class is going to disappear. More and more and more people are living in poverty. In fact, there was a report recently in the paper that 32% of the people in this country are effectively living in poverty because they're shelter poor. After they pay their mortgage, they don't have enough left for the basic necessities of life as defined by the federal Department of Health and Human Services. Mm. So that's 78 million people in this country are already at the poverty level.
And we're just starting.
We're just starting.
Do you think this is going to be sort of slow attrition, or is it going to be a dramatic crash, like the stock market crash of 1929 that was sort of a dramatic event that led to bank closings and then the foreclosures? Or do you think this is going to be a slower attrition that will be a little harder to see and to figure out?
Well, I think that it's going to be slow for two reasons. Mm-hmm. Number one, the financial markets are much better regulated now. You know, they've got these automatic shutoffs if the Dow drops so far, and they have other kinds of regulatory internal checks on the crashing. The other factor is that we've got what is called, it has been called, a rolling recession. So the Midwest goes down. It bottoms out, starts to slide up a little bit, and then Texas goes down, bottoms out, and then New England starts to go down.
So it's distributing the depression or recession to different parts of the country.
I think that the key problems are, if there is a big crash, it will come from the international markets. Right now, the dollar is still the standard of currency in global markets. And the Japanese are hard afoot to get off the dollar standard and go to a more independent measure. And when that happens, our currency is going to be worth less than the Argentine real or whatever they call their money. I mean, it's we're going to look like third world. Already, a cab ride from the airport in Tokyo costs $250. So it's like a Mexican peasant coming up here and taking a cab ride and trying to pay in pesos, and it's a quarter of his annual earnings. Right. Well, now if you go to Tokyo and you take a cab downtown, $250.
Well, it sounds to me like we need a war with Iraq to distract attention from all of these economic woes, that this is more entertainment for the people, seeing battles in the desert and hostage struggles. And this is sort of a popular culture, you know, good versus evil. In which
Hitler.
We're good and they're evil. There's Hitler out there to fight. Whereas if you look to see who the bad guys are in the savings and loan, this whole financial debacle, it's the establishment. It's the Congress, the presidency, the regulators, the wheelers and dealers. The entirety of the system is implicated in this.
Well, you know, if you go back and look at economic history, like the Great Depression or others that may or may not have been engineered by the big bankers, like Pierpont Morgan, etc. So frequently when things happened, it looked like economic forces were doing it, whereas other people who go back and look at it later and they find out, hey, there were certain manipulations that were going on that resulted in these things. And then what happened when the economy would collapse or there was a big depression, a lot of people were hurt, but the big guys up at the top would always prosper because they would go in and buy real estate and other property at various businesses at very low cost, so that they would really benefit and there would be more and more concentration of ownership up at the top. As a matter of fact, I read an article in one of the Wall Street Journal or somebody said a lot of the very wealthy people and wealthy in financial institutions have been building up an enormous war chest of extra money so that when the big crash comes, they can come in and buy up all this stuff that will be fire sale.
There's a famous quotation attributed to Baron von Rothschild, one of the great famous bankers of all time. And that quotation is, the best time to buy is when blood is running in the streets. And that's where we are.
And that's the end of this Alternative Views. We'd like to thank people who made our program possible. Our crew was Eric Eubank and Kevin L. West. And Ash. Goodbye.